a look at press freedom in Israel.
One problem that we're seeing, though, is that the lack of independent media in place to cover this war is allowing propaganda to really thrive on all sides.
Plus, a Russian weapon in space.
That it's also in the low Earth orbit path of a U.S. government satellite. So that's obviously an issue of concern.
And later, VOA catches up with the Speaker of the House, an update from Kyiv, and a look at the devastation in southern Brazil following devastating floods. Today is Thursday, May 23rd, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Amid an official mourning period, Iranian officials are cracking down on expressions of happiness and joy over the death of President Ibrahim Raisi. That story coming up later in the show. We begin, though, in the Middle East, where Gaza health officials said Israeli forces battled in close combat with Hamas-led militants in the southern city of Rafah on Thursday. The UNRWA, the main UN agency in Gaza, estimated that more than 800,000 people have fled the city of Rafah since the Israeli attacks began earlier this month. Gaza health officials also said 35 Palestinians were killed in aerial and ground bombardments across the Gaza Strip on Thursday. For its part, Israel says it has no choice but to attack Rafah in order to root out the last battalions of Hamas fighters it believes are sheltering there. After international condemnation, Israel has reversed its decision to cut the Associated Press's live feed of Gaza. The action comes amid increasing challenges for journalists covering the Israel-Hamas war. Christina Caicedo-Smith has the story.
A live feed of Gaza is cut on Tuesday as Israeli officials seize equipment from the Associated Press. The action met with international condemnation and the Israeli Communications Ministry hours later, reversed course and returned seized equipment. Israel had accused the AP of breaching the country's new foreign broadcaster law by providing content to banned outlet Al Jazeera. The AP rejected the claim. Julie Pace is executive editor of the Associated Press.
This shutdown was not based on the content of the feed, but rather an abusive use by the Israeli government of the country's new foreign broadcaster law. The live shot has generally shown smoke rising over Gaza.
The order, signed by Communications Minister Shlomo Kari, was condemned by the United Nations, White House, and media advocates. Here's Stefan Dujarric, the spokesperson for the UN Secretary General.
It's quite shocking. I think journalists need to be able to do their work freely. The Associated Press, of all news organizations, should be allowed to do its work freely and free of any harassment.
Israel used the new law earlier in May to ban Qatari broadcaster Al Jazeera over national security concerns. Israel's communications ministry said Tuesday it will take action to limit broadcasts that harm the security of the state. Free speech advocates warned that the law, along with restrictions on media access in the region, risk increasing mis- and disinformation about the conflict. The latest fighting began on October 7, when Hamas attacked Israel, killing 1,200 people and taking about 250 hostages. Israel responded with an air and land assault on Hamas-governed Gaza, killing more than 35,000 people, according to the local health ministry. Clayton Wimmers is the executive director of Reporters Without Borders U.S. Bureau.
One problem that we're seeing, though, is that the lack of independent media in place to cover this war is allowing propaganda to really thrive on all sides. And so the access of international media to Gaza is paramount.
Reporters Without Borders and other international watchdogs have also criticized Israel's record in ensuring press safety. Among the thousands killed so far are more than 100 journalists, nearly all Palestinian. Israel rejects the data on media deaths, saying the toll includes terrorists, a claim watchdogs firmly reject.
We take great care investigating each and every case. We do not count anyone who we reasonably think could be considered a Hamas militant among the journalists that we have counted as casualties of this war.
The AP live feed was back up Wednesday, but with Hamas still holding Israeli hostages and nearly three-quarters of Gaza's 2.3 million population displaced, media advocates say journalists need to be allowed to provide independent, verified information. Cristina Caicedo-Smith, VOA News.
Russian forces have started the first stage of exercises to simulate the launch of tactical nuclear weapons, and there is a satellite in space, orbiting Earth right now, that the Pentagon says is a Russian weapon. For some more, I'm joined by VOA's Catherine Gibson. So we know that the Pentagon has said there is a Russian satellite, it's orbiting Earth now, and they say it's probably a weapon. What kind of weapon is it?
That's right. So I spoke to some space diplomacy analysts yesterday. I also spoke with several lawmakers on Capitol Hill. This all seems to be an issue of top concern for them. And of course, we know that Russia has acted recklessly in space before. But what's new about this is that it seems to be some sort of observational satellite that could also possibly be used as a weapon, according to the Pentagon. And what seems to be concerning both the Pentagon and, you know, analysts who are watching this issue is that it's also in the low Earth orbit path of a U.S. government satellite. So that's obviously an issue of concern. So it is something that's being watched very closely in terms of kind of this new frontier that we have all of these other issues where the U.S. and Russia are in conflict, and now it looks like space is becoming another front in that battle.
So just to be clear, this isn't a weapon in space that would shoot down at the Earth. This is a satellite that would attack other satellites, rendering them useless.
That's correct, which of course could have very serious effects all on its own in terms of how much modern life relies on satellites. That could cripple numerous aspects of society. So even though it's not targeting Earth, it still is very much could have an impact on life on Earth.
So there's concern about Russian drills involving tactical nuclear weapons. There's concern about a Russian satellite-based weapon. What is the U.S., what is NATO prepared to do?
Well, in terms of the satellite issue, we saw a vote recently in the U.N. Security Council on a proposal that was introduced by Russia, so-called trying to keep safe, free, peaceful, keeping weapons out of space. The U.S. representative called this diplomatic gaslighting, and the resolution failed to get enough votes to pass. So I think we're going to be seeing a lot more of these battles on these fronts where Russia is putting forth statements and the U.S. is calling them out and saying, look, you're actually not really talking the talk. You're not backing this up with your actions. So we're going to be seeing a lot more of that in the future.
It's VOA's Catherine Gibson from Washington. Catherine, thanks for your time. Thanks for your reporting today.
You're so welcome.
Even as Russia is posturing with nuclear drills or using a space-based weapon as a deterrent, it's important to remember that there is a war going on. After illegally annexing Ukrainian land in 2014, Russia launched its full-scale invasion in February of 2022. The United States and other Western countries have been helping Ukraine defend itself, but with one important restriction. Kyiv is prohibited from using American weapons for attacks on Russian territory. And this is something that Kyiv would like to see changed, particularly as the Kharkiv region in eastern Ukraine is bombarded by missiles and drones launched from inside Russia. And not surprisingly, Kyiv has stepped up its lobbying on Washington to ease those restrictions. VOA's Katerina Lisanova caught up with Speaker of the House of Representatives, Mike Johnson, and asked him about it.
Your colleagues from House Intelligence Committee, they just released a statement in which they're calling for administration to allow Ukraine to use American weaponry on the military targets on Russian territory. Would you support that? Because right now they have weapons, but they have restrictions to use that.
I think we need to allow Ukraine to prosecute the war and the way they see fit. They have... They need to be able to fight back, and I think us trying to micromanage the effort there is not good policy for us.
So Mr. Support.
That's Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, speaking with VOA's Katerina Lisanova. And as noted above, Ukrainian leaders are pushing Washington to let them attack inside Russia with American weapons. VOA's Anna Chernikova has the latest from Kyiv, which is about 500 kilometers to the west of Kharkiv, which was bombarded with 15 Russian missiles today alone.
In a recent interview with Reuters, President Volodymyr Zelensky confirmed that Ukraine is negotiating with international partners about the possibility of using their weapons to strike targets inside the territory of Russia.
Чи можуть вони це зробити? Впевнений, так? Чи це наступ? Напад країни НАТО залучений?
So far, there is nothing positive, Zelensky said. The article does not specify whether Zelensky was talking about specific partners with whom Ukraine is conducting relevant negotiations. Last weekend, the Wall Street Journal reported that Ukraine addressed the Biden administration to help identify targets in Russia that Kyiv could strike with its own weapons, and separately asked to lift restrictions on the use of U.S.-provided weapons against military targets on the territory of Russia. The House Intelligence Committee has released a bipartisan letter to Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, urging him to expedite the delivery of weapons to Ukraine and allow Ukraine to attack targets in Russia. Meanwhile, Russian forces continue the constant shelling of the city of Kharkiv. As a result of the massive shelling on Thursday, the Russian forces hit civil infrastructure, residential areas, and the famous local publishing house Vivat. Transportation infrastructure and printing facilities were also destroyed. President Zelensky confirmed that the Russian forces hit Kharkiv and Lubutin in the Kharkiv region with 15 missiles at once. While Russia actively continues the shelling of Ukraine, President Zelensky calls on Ukraine's international partners to provide assistance in shooting down Russian missiles over Ukraine, as allies did when helping Israel repel the Iranian missile strike. He notes that such actions will in no way involve the allies in a direct confrontation with Russia, because the missiles are to be shot down over the territory of Ukraine without any damage to Russian planes or pilots. A number of countries support such an idea. In particular, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Poland said that Ukraine's request to shoot down Russian missiles from the territory of NATO countries is a matter for discussion. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Iran's Islamist rulers have begun cracking down on expressions of happiness by their opponents over President Ibrahim Raisi's death Sunday in a helicopter crash. Raisi, who died when his helicopter crashed in bad weather, was reviled by opponents of the Islamic Republic for his roles in mass killings of political prisoners and ordering deadly crackdowns on opposition protests. Iranian authorities have issued warnings and summoned citizens for questioning about social media posts celebrating Raisi's demise. One video on social media shows a woman walking in a park in Iran on Monday, handing out sweet pastries to passersby in celebration of Raisi's death. Sima Sabet is an independent Iranian journalist and analyst. My colleague Michael Lippin spoke with her on Wednesday and asked what she found most interesting about Iranians' reactions to the death of Raisi.
On the very first moment that there was news about the helicopter crash, people started making jokes.
So the humor started
quickly.
The humor
started very quickly. People were talking about how on earth it happened. And plus, I mean, the news, the way that it was disseminated on the government side, it left a lot of room for a sense of humor responses from people. Raisi was not a popular figure. He was seen as a murderer. He was in charge of thousands of executions in the first decade of the revolution, after the revolution. And also, he was a high official at a deputy level or the head of the judiciary system, which they sign all the execution orders, etc. He was at that position for over two decades. So for very long, he was in charge of killing and committing the crime against humanity in Iran. So many people reacted.
Humor is relatively easy to post online, but what about people actually coming out and celebrating in some physical way? We haven't seen so much of that inside Iran because people are probably a little scared about what would happen to them if they are found.
Many people, I mean, they put videos of their dance, singing, sharing sweets without showing their face. There were victims of the recent uprising that they were dancing and they were sharing drinks. I can recall Mercedes and Sima. Mercedes lost an eye by shooting of the security forces during the recent uprising of Mahsa Amini in 2022. She's now in Germany. She had to leave the country because it was not safe for her, and she had lost an eye. She needed treatment. But she was dancing and she was sharing a drink. Mahsa and Roya Pirayi, they lost their mother, Minu Majidi, during the uprising. They were also one of the first ones that they shared a drink, like they were cheersing and they were celebrating.
Inside Iran?
No, both of them are outside of Iran.
So it's easier for them to do such things publicly when they're outside the country.
Yes, the ones that they were sharing sweets or celebrating inside Iran, mostly they were trying not to show their faces, but some of the families of the victims and the people who they were killed during the uprising, they had reactions on social media. But the government doesn't allow them to react or show their happiness of what had happened to Raisi as someone who was in position of being a president during the uprising, which they killed over 500 people and they injured thousands. And the government is using this opportunity in order to show that he had massive support.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because apparently hundreds of thousands of people were on the streets of Tehran today, Wednesday, for this big funeral procession led by the Supreme Leader Khamenei. How impressive was that for you?
Well, it was not impressive. We know that when there is a government official ceremony happening in Iran, they bring people from all those governmental organizations from everywhere. Anywhere that people are working, they are forced into attending that ceremonies. It's not necessarily because they're willing to go, they have to go. Because the government, of course, is going to monitor who went and who didn't. So those big numbers that they came, they weren't all government supporters. They came from the organizations, the governmental organizations. And also there is a minority of the traditional supporters that they are supporting the government.
When we consider that many opponents of the Iranian government have been expressing their happiness at Raisi's demise, what is the chance that that kind of happiness could translate into potentially a new revived protest movement like we saw in 2022?
Well, Iran is like a volcano. It will erupt because the pressure on people is a lot. They are under pressure by not having freedom, by being under pressure of government on every aspect of their life, let alone from how you cover your head, what you're going to wear, how you're going to socialize, where you go, what you eat, when you eat. These are the very simple, ordinary aspects of any human being, which the Iranian government surprisingly tries to control and impose that ideology of Shia Islam into the people's life. People are going to explode, like Iran is going to erupt in any moment.
That's VOA's Michael Lippin. He was speaking with independent Iranian journalist Sima Sabet. And finally today, as floodwaters recede in southern Brazil, a tragic scenario is unfolding with more than 500,000 people displaced, 160 confirmed dead, and nearly 100 still missing. Jan Boischat went to the scene and has this report from Rio Grande do Sul.
Hundreds of thousands of Brazilians still have their homes underwater more than 2 weeks after the rivers began to rise in southern Brazil, causing the region's worst flooding in record story. In areas where the water is receding, mud, trash, and destruction are everywhere. Slowly, the waters are also revealing the grisly reality of what were the last moments for many and the accounts of what was for others a lucky escape.
Paulo, an auto mechanic who only gave his first name, says he and his family left their home just in time.
As pessoas vão começar a aparecer.
People will start to show up. A lot of people died while sleeping. I took my family in the dead of night. I was checking the water levels all the time. Only at the last moment did we leave. A lot of people died sleeping.
Official lists had almost 100 people still missing on Wednesday. Rescue teams have been looking for bodies with the help of dogs. This corpse was found on Monday, trapped inside his house in a city close to Porto Alegre, the capital city of Rio Grande do Sul, Brazil's southernmost state. By Wednesday, more than 160 bodies had been found. Porto Alegre sits on the shore of a large lake that receives water from at least four big rivers flowing from mountain areas affected by historic rainfall volumes last week. Upstream, the water swept many towns away quickly and suddenly. Here, at the mouth of the rivers, it happened at a slower pace, but the effects were also larger. Most of the 500,000 displaced people live around the state capital. Among them is Elio Poncio, a 62-year-old construction worker who says evacuees are getting the basics. He says people are helping them with food, water, the most important things, and also with clothes. He says he and others lost everything and they have nothing left in their home anymore. The water, he says, went over the roof. Poncio is living with his family in a makeshift hut not far from his damaged home, along with many of his neighbors. He says they feared violence and lack of privacy in a shelter. Now, he fears his son, Mauricio, may have contracted leptospirosis, a deadly infection from bacteria in contaminated waters. More than 50,000 people are in shelters, and the local government has announced it will build at least four refugee camps to accommodate them. At the same time, thousands of dogs and cats that were left behind have been rescued. Many of them are living in shelters, waiting to be found by their owners.
Foi no momento de desespero.
Davidson Santos, a 22-year-old student, says it was a moment of despair. As the water started to rise, he says, his elderly parents could not bring their dog. Santos says they searched for the animal for days. Zhu was found almost 2 weeks later in this shelter. He was scared, but seemed ready to start a new life, like so many people here. Yabuesha, Rio Grande do Sul, VOA News.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.